Happen Podcast, a podcast for people working in the real world of IT. It's This Happen, and work in the help desk, a network engineer, an IT consultant, a computer tech, you want to know more about servers, or even if you want to get a job in the IT field, this podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Al.
And I'm Andy.
And I'm Jerry.
And this is episode 44. Now, if you ever want to dial the UK outside of the UK, then you have to dial 44 before the number that you want. That's the international dialing code. Also, as well, isn't there Smith & Wesson 44 Magnum? I don't have to know. Did Dirty Harry have that gone?
Yeah, he did.
It
was.
It's going to blow his head clean off.
Yeah. Well, do you?
You feel lucky, punk. Also 44, it's the race number of Lewis Hamilton. M44 is the beehive cluster. And as far as I know, although you might know of something, there's no official port numbers that you'd use, but there's nothing officially assigned to port number 44. Not that I know of, anyway. This is a favourite one of mine. 44 in the game of bingo is known as all the fours droopy draws. So that's £44 in weight is equivalent to 20 kilograms. And it's also the number of the house that Jerry grew up in.
It certainly is, yeah.
Not that I knew that beforehand, he just told me just before we started. what's everyone been up to this week? Because we're kind of, it's almost like a continuation of last week, this one, isn't it? We didn't have time to fit everything in last week, so it's kind of spilling over into this episode. So
with your adventures in Linux,
we nearly had a 2-hour episode with all that though. So but this is a new week, so what have you been up to?
I've been installing WordPress on Windows. We had a request to get WordPress installed on Windows, so on a Windows web server. So, like, you know, when you get for Linux, you get like an Apache or an Nginx server running PHP to run MySQL to run WordPress. We had a request.
The so-called LAMP stack.
Yes. we had a server 2012 was running IIS, which is basically like the Windows version. It was Windows web server, normally using like .NET and AASP to host what the websites you're running on it. But this customer wanted to run a WordPress site in it, so there's a nice little a codex thing from WordPress where you can literally install it, and it will basically, I'll put links in the show notes. Basically, you install it, and it basically downloads MySQL for you. And it installs a PHP into IIS for you. When you install it, it basically installs MySQL. You set a root password, then it goes off and downloads PHP and WordPress. I don't know if you'd come across this before, but I didn't actually get to use it. But like, when you install in WordPress, you get security keys now, which you're meant to use. So it was meant to make it secure. I don't know if you come across that before. With like authentication keys and security authentication, like those random wrong keys. So you put all that in, and you basically installs WordPress, and you get a default WordPress install.
Yeah, I have seen that. Those auth key, secure key, and logged in key that goes into the wp-config.php.
Yeah.
It's just a load of cryptographic stuff which I don't really understand, but it makes it all nice and secure.
So it's quite good. So yeah, he could, it was on, so it's really good. And then all you have to do is that he'd already got a, so that basically, when you install it, that basically just gives you a blank WordPress site. So when you go to the default website, it just says, oh, you want to set up WordPress, what's the mail database name, whatever it normally does. But he already got his SQL, his WordPress site from another server. So all he had to do is restore the SQL database and then restore the files. So I'd never heard of this one. It's a thing called MySQL Workbench before for Windows. It's like a little utility front end for MySQL. And you basically just load up, connect to MySQL, and then you can import and then back up and restore your databases. So yeah. Nice little easy one. If anyone has to install that, I'll put the links in the show notes for that.
Yeah, I've, quite a lot of the stuff I do is WordPress related. In fact, I just had a client literally right now on Hangouts as we're recording asking me some questions about WordPress. it's in demand. I think it's one of the most popular platforms for web development, really. And you get a lot of PHP programmers. It has some concept of themes and plugins, which themes is kind of the way it looks, and plugins add functionality.
Yeah.
Functionality to it. So you can just use it as like a kind of what you see is what you get thing, which is what we do for our website.
Yeah.
But you can also go a bit deeper and make it do other things as well. So.
Yeah, because I've been looking at, say, a BSD, free BSD server, and using FAMP, you know, talking about LAMP, so it's FAMP, FEMP, so it's a Linux, okay. So it'll be free BSD and Nginx and MySQL and PHP, so...
Okay.
I'll let you know how I get on with that.
Yeah. Although, I mean, this, you know, you've got WAMP and for Windows,
yep.
Windows, Apache, MySQL, PHP, and MAMP for Mac... Mm-hmm. So that's used by people, developing. You know, a lot of web developers have Macs and they develop on their Macs.
Yeah.
So, but with Linux, it's a lot easier, I found, to just, you know, do apt-get install or yum install the packages.
Yeah.
And then get going from there. So I don't know, with FreeBSD, it might be easier to just install the packages rather than install some kind of unified thing.
I'm going to install the thing separately. So install,
So you probably have Nginx, you have a PHP plugin for Nginx.
Yes.
You have the PHP MySQL thing, and then obviously MySQL itself and PHP itself. So, mm-hmm. So yeah. Complicated, but once you've done it once, you don't need to do it again.
Mm-hmm. Cool. It's cool. So what have you two been up to then since last week?
Well, I've got this... been doing two major things, I suppose, since we last... two in the dentist's office, both owned by the same company. And what they've been doing is they're doing an upgrade of some of the computers. Over the two dental offices, they had 8 XP computers, amazingly. But they were still running okay, but they're just getting a bit slow. Plus, as well, they found out from Exact, who make the software for it, that some of the newer versions won't be supported in XP coming up the end of this year or beginning of next year or whatever. So they decided to get some... they actually got some reconditioned Dell computers with Windows 7 on and 4 gig and stuff like that. So they're perfectly suitable for what they wanted to do. So I've actually spent 2 days, not all day, but 2 different days setting up these new computers and getting them installed. Sounds pretty easy, but it's actually... You know, just a bit. I mean, it's easy in a way. It's just a bit logistically complicated because, obviously, the surgeries are still in use at the time. So I've got to try and. I was actually getting the computers plugged in, installed, and get them all set up in the reception area around the back, and then I had to kind of wait until he had 10-15 minutes. With no patients in, that I could run in there with the computer and swap it over.
Mm-hmm.
And so I basically had to try and get 99% of everything working out you know, in the reception area around the back. So when I went and plugged it in, it would just work. And the next patients would come in and they'd carry on as if nothing had happened. I don't know if you, because you've done some, you worked at the exact place, didn't you, once, Al? Or you did something to do with that?
Well, we used to had, I worked for a dental company, and exact was our main kind of thing. We had 140 practices running it. So.
Right. Well, do you remember the thing with the licenses and that? So they have to have, the parts of the company have so many licenses within mm-hmm. that practice. So say, for example, there's 8 of them. Of course, what we had to do, each computer, so what it, how it works is a computer name got given a license. So because 4 of those computers were getting taken away, we had to go in and remove those exact 4 licenses.
Mm-hmm.
So there was then 4 licenses available. And then what happened is when you plugged the new computer in and exact was installed on it, you know, we put that on to begin with. The moment it logged in for the first time, it then got allocated at one of the licenses that are available. We had to make sure that we did that first, otherwise there'd be no allocations of licenses available. So they didn't have to, you know, buy 4 more. They could just literally remove them from 4 computers and then reinstall them on another 4. Yeah. So it actually all went pretty well, but at the same token as well, I had to get the all the printers all set up. Some of the computers, like especially in reception, had the one today had a flatbed scanner that needed setting up.
Yeah,
it's this old Canon scanner from years ago. And when I checked on the website, it didn't have any Windows 7 drivers available for it.
Was it still parallel or was it USB?
USB. Yeah. But it had Vista drivers and it had XP drivers.
Yeah.
And none of them worked. So they've had to order a new scanner. But there's all sorts of bits like that. Another thing that they came across as well, they didn't really think about this, and I didn't think about it either, is most of the keyboards and mice that they had there, they were all PS2 sockets on them.
Yeah.
And of course, because they're reconditioned Dell, right? Yeah. Then they've all got USB.
Mm-hmm.
So they've had to go and get they've had about 8, you know, 6 or 7 new keyboards and mice as well to go with it all. But the whole process went pretty well, really, considering you just had to work within the gaps that the dentists had in order to get them in there. And
Did you think about using something like VNC or remote desktop to depends what the network's like in the surgery, but you could actually do it while there's you know, root canal work going on in the
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean, and I suppose it could have, but I had a little set up in the reception where it was. So they were half installed, these Windows computers. They were half ready to go. So it was just getting them set up there. And then when they were ready, just move them in. And it worked. And I suppose I could have done it that way. But it all worked pretty well at the end of it. Another thing I've been doing this week as well, I've got a new customer that's been... I've been referred to, or they've given, well, someone's give them my number, basically. I'm doing this all remotely. I mean, they live in Warrington. I suppose it's about an hour away, but this has been a bit of a mail migration thing, if you like. This guy was with a company called... I don't know if I say the company's name, I suppose so, didn't do anything wrong, but they're called Simple EMS, and they're basically they do things like exchange servers and stuff like that. And when he's got this new computer, he wanted to go over to 365. Now they sorted it all out for him, and then they migrated his emails over from his old server, which I suppose they looked after, onto the MS 365 servers. I thought I was going to have to do quite a bit of it, but they ended up doing most of it. And I tell you what, though, it worked really well, because once the account was set up, it did take a while, though. It took about 24 hours to do. I don't know if that is that normal to do a migration of mail, about 24 hours.
I think possibly if you're changing the MX record, so So when you change a mail server, you've got for a domain, to something else, you change the MX record in DNS.
Okay.
And that can take up to 48 hours to propagate.
So what took 24 hours to do then? What were you?
He asked them if he could set up 365, through them, billing through them.
Yeah. Right?
And they said, yeah, no problem. And they give him a username and password to get onto the Microsoft portal to download it from.
Yeah.
So if you can imagine this, he had a new laptop and an old laptop. So we got onto the new laptop. His old laptop was running on the old mail server, exchange. Everything was fine.
Yeah.
Right? This is a remote exchange, not in his place. So then we set up that, and then I could download Office directly from the Microsoft portal.
Yeah.
Which worked great, and everything installed. That was great. Then, of course, you get Office 2016 on it, and Outlook 2016, I should say. Brought that down, added an account to it, which was the new account details.
Yeah.
And it connected straight away. But, of course, when it connected straight away, there was no emails in the mailbox whatsoever.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's going to be a DNS issue then.
Could have been, yeah.
Yeah.
So then... went back. So I got onto Skype. We've been doing this by Skype, you see. Then I got back onto Skype to talk to him, and he said, my old emails on the old computer are still coming through, right? So all the mail were going to the old mail server on the old computer. So we got back in touch with this company again, told them where we were up to, and he said, right, okay, right, we'll start the process now. It may take 24 hours to do, and we'll send you an email when it's completed. So we left him to it. And then, trying to think what happened next. Then it went through a period where he didn't get any email anywhere. And he went through a period, I'm talking a couple of hours here. Then he went through a period where his entire old exchange mailbox was empty, right? And when he went onto the new mailbox, that was empty. So at this point, he was actually getting a little bit concerned at this point. And I said to him, oh, it's all right, it's just migrating across. We'll just have to wait, you know. And then when I connected up later, brought up Outlook on the new machine, then all of a sudden it started synchronizing and all of his folders came through and all of that lot. But that whole process took 24 hours. So, as far as I know, the data, the raw data, has been moved as well.
So he must use some migration tool in the background to do that. Then I don't understand why it disappeared after the old email deleted. So
That was done by that Simply MS. That's the name of the company, anyway. But everything went through and everything worked and everything's gone fine. It did take probably longer than I expected, but saying that, he did have a huge mailbox as well. So I don't know what the kind of normal is. I think it was something like, I think it was like 6 or 7 gigabyte mailbox or something like that. And if that's changing from one exchange server to another, would that take that long,
Normally what we do is use an online service, which basically you do like a pre-batch. So you point it to your old exchange server, and it basically in the background, it migrates everything until 30 days ago.
Okay.
And then you change the DNS records across and say, right, go to the new, all email now goes to the new server.
Okay.
And then we do a final you do another migration, what it says, collect the last 30 data, so you only got to get the last 30 data, so there's not much changed. And okay. then the mails migrated to the new system, and the emails are direct. You update the DNS records as well for the MX records, and they come through, kind of thing. So,
Okay.
Just some input from the Linux side. I think it's quite similar to Exchange in that you've got basically a folder structure that is your inbox, and then you the way that I've done it in the past is copy that mailbox over to the new server and just have it sitting there. There's a utility called IMAP copy, which I use for that, which sounds similar to that migration tool. And then, just switch the DNS records. And if they're using mail clients, put in the information for the new server. And I've actually used that to migrate from like a hosted IMAP mailbox to one on the server, so that's worked pretty well. But if you do have the option to put the TTL and the DNS record down, then you should, because that means basically that the
MX record,
things that are sending mail to that MX record will go to the new one sooner, basically.
Yeah. It will check every hour. I normally put it down to an hour. But it depends if your DNS servers are people who DNS servers are actually kind of abiding by the TTL.
Yeah.
All right. So what have you been up to then, Jerry?
I touched on a few things last week, and I probably might want to go into that in a bit more detail. So recently, I don't know when this show's going to go out, but I went to Glastonbury. So Glastonbury is somewhere you don't want to take your laptop. So I had to get a lot of things into shape before I went, because I handed over to a good friend of mine who's also a Linux admin. To basically cover me while I was away, which I've done for him a couple of times. But the problem kind of came down to a couple of things. Basically, a couple of clients wanted me to set up some LAMP servers for them. We talked about LAMP earlier. Basically, to host their websites and migrate from old servers to a new servers in one case, and just to set up a new website in another case. And as well as this, I had to hand over all the stuff that all the stuff I normally look after to my mate. And in doing this, I realised how much of it was in my head. I guess the kind of takeaway from it is, get everything documented. In my case, it's kind of get everything into Ansible, because if you can configure everything in Ansible, it's all in code which you can pass around. You can put it on GitHub if you want. Make sure you remove all the secrets, but have it all clear in your head, there shouldn't be anything that someone else couldn't do if they needed to. So if anyone's doing what I'm doing, that's a bit of a pro tip. Get your act together and be prepared to hand it over to someone else in a kind of uncomplicated way, I suppose, because you don't want to have to spend a couple of hours or a couple of days doing that. So it's good to do that in advance, basically. And then at work, I had problem with an SSL certificate. So the weekend before I went to Glastonbury, the SSL certificate ran out. They're generally good for a year, or increments of a year, so a year, 2 years, 3 years. This one happened to run out on the 19th of June, and I was due to go away on the 21st. So I thought I'd sorted everything out. I think I may have gone over this last episode, but I got a new certificate, well, you know, the week beforehand, and I put that certificate on the load balancers, which are in AWS. You generally don't have a web server just sitting there. You have a load balancer in front of it, and then if you want to put more web servers behind that, then the load balancer will put an equal amount of traffic to the web servers that are behind it. So I'd replaced the SSL certificate on the load balancers. Everything was good. But it turned out that part of the way that we do things is we use the CloudFront in AWS, which is a content delivery network, which is basically a service which will put cache your data. We're actually using it because we're using S3, which is the Amazon storage service. So what we're using it for is Debian repository. Now we deploy our code using Debian packaging, so if anyone is familiar with Linux, you do apt-get install to install packages on the system.
Yeah.
We also use it to deploy the code on the system. We don't use CloudFront to deploy that, but we use CloudFront to turn an S3 bucket into an apt repository for Ubuntu / Debian. So basically, that the SSL certificate was incompatible with CloudFront, so the whole deploy process using apt didn't work. I probably said this already, but I found this out as I was walking away from work to catch my train home the day before I went to Glastonbury. So as it turned out, it was down to the key, I believe, or maybe just the certificate itself was 4096 bit rather than 2048 bit. So if anyone is using CloudFront and SSL certificates, you have to get a 2048-bit certificate, not a 4096-bit, because the 4096-bit won't work. So that basically, while I was away at Glastonbury, no one could deploy any code. As it turned out, there wasn't any code that needed deploying, but it could have been a lot worse than that, so... Yeah, another lesson learned there. I got a few calls from a client when I was at Glastonbury because this, you know, this deadline had come up in the previous week. Basically, if you're going away, get your stuff sorted out beforehand, preferably a week or so beforehand, so you haven't got any worries when you're actually away.
Yeah, because you're going about certificates. So there used to be like a really unsecure, which is 1028, isn't it? And then you get 2048 and then 4096, isn't it? It's just kind of like...
Yeah. I think it's Diffie-Hellman 1024-bit is now considered insecure.
Very insecure.
But it was, you know, up until maybe a year ago, it was considered okay. But
Yeah.
I think to play it safe... Go for 2048-bit, and I think that's the length of the private key that you use to generate the certificate signing request, which is then used to generate the certificate.
Because apparently 1024 RS keys have been cracked. Sorry.
So, yeah.
So they recommend. And
there's something to do with Diffie-Hellman key exchange, which is to do with the whole conversation that goes on to. When you do private public key cryptography. Listen to Security Now if you want a good explanation of that, because Steve Gibson explains it much better than I can. Other than that, I've been doing a lot of stuff with Terraform and Ansible for a freelance client. A lot of the Terraform stuff that I've picked up in my day job, so that's pretty useful. And I think I've already mentioned I'm doing a couple of proof of concept environments for Isinga and Nagios, which are these monitoring systems. And I've been playing around just in the last couple of days with Amazon Route 53, which is their managed DNS service. And you can use Terraform to programmatically create DNS records and so on.
Yeah, because you can do Route 53, you can do like global DNS world, can't you? So it will basically push it to the...
I'm actually using it for private DNS, so you can use it. I just want to be able to say, you know, ping this host and have it have it automatically put a name in.
Yeah.
So that's what I've been doing, and I've been playing with VPCs as well, which are like the... We've talked about them before. They're the AWS equivalent of VLANs, really. Mm-hmm. So I think I've got a bit more to do there, but there's a lot more than just setting up the servers for this particular job. It's working out all these intricacies of AWS, and I think Terraform does help with that, because you're basically putting it all in code.
Yeah.
So like a couple of times, I've taken it down, I've destroyed everything, and then built it straight back up from the code. So it's really useful to have that. And the code's not that difficult to understand. I mean, if I can do it, I'm sure anyone can. So.
So you had to set up from LAMP servers as well. And did you script that at all, or did you?
Yeah, I did that all in Ansible. It took me a while to do it in Ansible, but if I ever need to do it again, I now can. And the reason is I've never set up a LAMP server in Ansible before. I've just, jumped onto different LAMP servers and maybe configured them using Ansible. But I've never actually done one from scratch. Well, I have now, but yeah.
Cool. That's good. You had a problem with OpenSSL as well then, or did you say...
No, OpenSSL. I'll just put something in the show notes, probably in last week's show notes as well, about OpenSSL commands. So you can do all sorts of things like generating a private key, generating a certificate signing request, inspecting a CSR or private key to find out its details, and inspecting the certificate, useful for finding out when the certificate runs out. If you just go onto a box and just have a certificate there.
Yeah.
You can find out all the details about it and so on, even who issued it, so you can go back to them to reissue it and so on.
Cool. Well, I've been having fun with VSS Writer as well. I don't think I've ever talked about this in the show before. I was trying to look through the show notes to find out about it, but VSS permitting is volume shadow copies or volume snapshots. So it's kind of using backup. So if you're backing up a server, like I've heard me talk about Veeam before, and if you're backing up a server it's a virtual server, it's got like a MySQL database on it or Exchange database on it. If you just back those raw files up, if you ever have to go to restore it, you could be to a point where it's got corrupt data because you haven't snapshot the application. So what VSS does is that it will, we're using VSS Writer inside Windows, it will freeze the machine for like a microsecond or something, and it will put the data into somewhere else, so that when it's snapshotting, it will have an actual image of where that machine was at that exact point in time. And if you have to restore that machine, it basically can manage to put the data back into it properly. And yeah, then you have a clean image. So if you boot the machine up, it will be like it was it's been happy. But if anyone's working in the IT world before, you get these VSS errors. And the only way you can kind of normally fix them is by rebooting a server, which is not always typical. But there is a command you can run. You have to do evaluate command on command prompt. That's right click command prompt and run as administrator. And if you type in vsadmin list writers, it will tell you what the state of the VSS writers are. And there'll be like one for everything what's installed in that server. So if you've got SQL, it'll have a SQL site, VSS Writer. If you've got Exchange, it'll have one on there, DFS kind of thing. And it basically tells you, I'll put the link in the show notes, but how you can get, so it basically said like, it will say like VSS status, it will say like error or stopped or something like that. And you want it to be, say, stable, so it's ready to run when you need the next actual. And so what you can do is you can follow this sheet and you can like restart the services, which is related to that thing. So like for the RS writer, you need to restart the volume shadow copy name. So it's quite good, but you must be careful. Like there's one that's like, if you want to redo like the AD one or the IIS one, it could stop and restart your IIS server. So I'll put a link in the show notes for that. So that you can.
Do you know if it uses a copy on write type thing for a snapshot? Or
I don't know how it works. It basically just freezes the machine for a couple of seconds or microsecond, and it basically writes it to somewhere else so that it knows what the data's changed since the snapshot was taken. So that it, when it writes it to the backup media, it writes both the two files, the what's before taken before the snapshot and then what's taken after the snapshot kind of thing. So it's all magic from Microsoft Magic. Also, as well, I've been working this week is synchronising FTP or scripting FTP. I'll put a link in the show as well, a product called Script FTP and FTP synchronisation software. And we've got a couple of customers who have got a need to transport EDI stuff. So I don't know. I think EDI stands for like electronic delivery information or something, does it? Have you ever come across this before? It's a way of transferring data between two systems, electronic data interchange. So this is like things like if you've got one company and they want to interchange data from another company. So like, this company transports food from one place to another. So it has an EDI link to a shipping company. So to ship the data, so to process it, to do the ordering, to get the lorries to go and pick up the meat or whatever, it does a EDI exchange using FTP. So the customers, the haulage company's got an FTP server, and with the software, you either script it or use a synchronization tool. And what happens is that once a file's put into this folder, so an order's made on the EDI in their business application software, business line of application, it puts a file into a folder, and then the software goes, oh, there's a new EDI claim, and it then transfer using FTP by a scheduler to go to the other end of the haulage company, and that then obviously they do something there and it goes, oh look, we've got a new order kind of thing. So it's all interesting. So it's a little script. I think you have to pay like $21 or something for the FTP script, but you could do lots of things. So it could say like I don't know, if the letter, the start of the letter, the file begins A, go to this place kind of thing. It's all kind of very good scripting.
I spend a lot of time telling my clients not to use FTP because it sends everything in plain text.
Well, this was actually using SFTP. So,
okay, yeah. Oh, that's all right, yeah.
So port 22 kind of thing. Mm. So
it's also a lot easier to manage with because you need two ports with FTP, don't you?
Yeah.
And, you know, you have to have you have to do certain configuration, whereas SFTP it's just SSH basically.
Well, depending on is it static or what was it? There used to be two types of FTP, didn't there?
Active and passive.
Yeah,
wasn't it?
Yeah. So that's another interesting thing I did this week. Which, if you need to automate FTP, I'll put links in the show notes. Also, I had the other day, I had to find, I needed to get a Windows 10 password from the Wi-Fi. I connected to a Wi-Fi connection at our local Scout Hut, and I wanted to know, and I couldn't remember what the key was, because I was moving from one laptop to another. And you can basically, there's a command you can run in Windows 10, which will show all the Windows T, what like the codes for the Wi-Fi are. So
that's handy.
Yeah.
I mean, Windows 10 doesn't seem to have a good record when it comes to Wi-Fi, though, does it?
No.
Wasn't it like you share it on Facebook or something?
Or there was like a thing, there's like a function you could... We covered in the show before. Yeah, so you can basically just read the... we have talked about it, the net sh command before. But if you type in net sh space wlan space show space profiles, it shows you all the Wi-Fi profiles you've ever connected to. And then you can, once you've done that, you can do the same command, net sh space wlan show space profile space name, and then the equals, then the profile name, then space key equals clear. It will basically show you what the WTAT key command is. So
that's pretty handy, because there's been quite a few times where I think it's either my laptop's a bit connected to this hotspot before and I need to connect my phone, or vice versa, where it would actually be useful to have that information. Yeah.
Another thing as well, if you ever come across this bar, is like, if you set a proxy server up before, so customers, you just have to go through a proxy server to get onto the internet. You know, I was talking about group policy last week, where you can push out settings to PCs, okay?
Mm-hmm.
What happens is you can configure it to do that, so you can push it out, say, Internet Explorer users use this proxy server to connect to it. But you also can be even clever, because you're probably doing this to like stop people browsing websites. So you want to basically put them through a proxy server that blocks certain things. Obviously, people can go into the internet settings to disable the proxy server settings. But also, what you can do is you can also, in Greek policy, you can hide that tab so you can't see it, which is quite good, so they can't go in there. But if you ever want to change it, so you want to disable it for testing, it's quite difficult. Because you obviously can't go into Internet Explorer and disable it without going into group policy and then saying, don't apply this group policy to this computer, works. But we had a problem last week where we had a problem with a Hyper-V server. I could manage to get into ILO. You probably heard me talk about ILO before, is where you can kind of connect to the console of the server and then you can see what's happening.
Yeah,
and then
yeah.
You can reboot it remotely, kind of thing, which is quite cool. Like, press to hold the power button in if it crashes or something. But the ILO would work fine to get to the web page. But when you try to do this ILO thing, actually the console, it was using a Java app. And that was like, it couldn't... No, sorry, it was using .net, and it couldn't connect to the console because it had the proxy was blocking it. So I found this little reg hack. Because I had admin rights on this PC, I could go into registry. And all Greek policies are is basically putting registry keys down to the machine to lock things down. So
I was listening to... There's quite a good explanation on the episode of TechSnap recently, because there was a security issue with Greek policies a couple of weeks ago, wasn't there?
Yeah, what I was talking about last week on the last episode.
Yeah.
But they were saying it's because people, Microsoft, big thing, they broke it all. But if you just set up your Greek policy properly in the past, like I did last week, even when it broke, even applying that patch wouldn't have broken it, kind of thing. I even thought about emailing in to explain that, but I haven't got around to doing that yet. I was getting really annoyed going, it isn't because Microsoft, you need...
I was behind my podcast, so I've literally just listened to it today, so, because of Glastonbury, yeah, like I was saying earlier.
Yeah, but I do like that Alan Jude guy, he does know his stuff, and he's the one who's trying to get me, he's got me into doing about free BSD. So all you need to do, I'll put a link in the show notes for this, so it's quite handy. I don't know why I haven't thought about this in the past, but all you need to do is going into, literally go into HK current user, software policy, Microsoft Internet Explorer control panel, and then you and there's something you, I can't remember what, that's not the link in the show notes I've put in, doesn't actually put the one in there. Yeah, I'll basically find it and put it in the show notes. So it's basically a thing you can enable. You put enable zero and it basically put that connection tab back in, and then you can go into IE again and it will be there. And then you can untick the box saying use a proxy server. So, yes, so that's good.
Another pro tip for the end user here. If you download PuTTY, you can, and you've got a handy server on the internet somewhere, you can proxy through that instead.
Mm-hmm. So what problem have you been having in OS X then, Jerry?
It's really annoying. It seems quite antiquated because you have to configure it all through a GUI. So you have to either have a keyboard and mouse on the machine itself, or use the screen sharing, which is basically VNC. And it does all this editing of files behind the scenes. Because it's Unix, yeah, or BSD, like, you can go onto the machine and edit those files. But I found the Apache conf for this server. They're using it to build iOS apps because they've got Mac Mini, and the only way you can do these builds is have a Mac and Xcode to build this stuff on. They need various things sorting out on this Mac Mini, and they're using OS X Server to do like web serving and things like that, and it's got a GUI. Just like Windows, but it's also got all this. The GUI translates to these normal Linux-y, Unix-y text files for configuration, and it seems to be broken in some way because I can't get it to serve. I've got this new SSL certificate, like I said, and it's not working properly. Maybe I'll try the. I'll try doing a new one with a 2048-bit key instead of 4096-bit. Maybe that's why it's not working, but it's just for someone like me that just wants to go in and change everything, and I can see the files there, it's quite frustrating to have to use the GUI because the GUI doesn't actually expose all the things that I need to do as well, so it's a bit... That's why I'm finding it annoying.
Can you still buy OXS server then?
Yeah, apparently, yeah. I mean, for every new version of OS X, there's a version of OS X server. But I think, annoyingly, the functionality changes what you can actually do with OS X server changes on the whim of Apple. So yeah, it's not ideal. I'd have it all set up in Ansible and do it that way, but it doesn't seem like that's possible.
Cool. There we go. Okay. So you basically did you just try to get your new certificate on there, are you? Is that what you're trying to do?
The old certificate doesn't work anymore. So they're using it for they've got Jenkins
build server,
which I might mention before, doing the builds for the these mobile apps. Yeah. And whenever they go to the web page, they get a warning because the SSL certificate isn't valid. So I've done I've followed all the steps to update it, but it's still not working. And I've got very little time for it because I'd rather do the more interesting stuff with on the actual infrastructure. It's a bit of a thorn in my side, but it's not too bad. Yeah. I've had worse.
And you've had a problem with PHP as well then, kind of thing?
There's a client the other day and he wanted I don't know if it's a plugin or a class for PHP called SwiftMailer. It's basically, how to describe it? It's if you think of a Python module or a Node.js module, it's basically a chunk of code which you put into the PHP or whatever language you're using. Now. to do this, I used this bit of software called Composer, which it basically, like, if you, it's a package manager, so the packages have dependencies. So this thing called SwiftMailer that I wanted to install, it may have dependencies on other things, like, I don't know, certain libraries that do certain things in PHP. So I got this Composer installed, and it wanted to upgrade the version of PHP. I think it was for security reasons in the end. And so I happily upgraded PHP on this guy's server, and I got the... it's a bit of a famous error in WordPress, establishing a database connection, which basically means that the PHP code can't communicate with the MySQL server, because WordPress puts a lot of data about the website in the database. MySQL, you probably use other databases as well, but so I spent a good couple of hours trying to get to the bottom of this. You know, in the middle of the day, this guy's site was down, so it was a bit intense. And in the end, it turned out that the version of MySQL that I had to upgrade to didn't like the passwords, the way the passwords were stored. So the fix was to just set the password again for the username host that's specified in WordPress. I mean, Al, you probably be aware that you need to specify the username, password, and the database and the host. But all I had to do was set the password again, and I had to put a thing in the mysql.conf, old passwords equals no. So it didn't use this older style of password. I'm still not entirely sure, you know, what the actual problem was, but that's what fixed it. So resetting the passwords. It's to do with the way the passwords are stored in the database. So WordPress couldn't connect to the database because, as far as the database was concerned, it was giving it an invalid password. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
So definitely one to keep in the back pocket there. Lastly, probably, I went to the AWS summit in London last week, which was quite interesting.
Okay.
It's basically free, so, you know, if anyone wants to go to the next one, it's free to register and free to get in.
Mm-hmm.
You just need a spare day and a willing employer, or you know, take some holiday or whatever. And so if you want to know anything more about AWS, there's lots of different talks and so on that you can go to. Personally, I mean, it's not really anything to do with my work, but the talk I found the most interesting was about HPC. So that stands for high performance computing. It's basically clusters of computers doing parallel computing on various jobs for scientific purposes. So something this company that was giving the talk had done, they'd got this thing in the AWS marketplace. So basically you get an AWS account, you log in, and it will automatically set up all these servers for you and enable you to run your jobs on them. And it uses something called, in AWS, you've got this thing called spot instances. So what those are you can spin up these instances, which come from the unused capacity in AWS. So at any time, AWS has something like 80%, 90% of its machines that are just sitting there,
mm-hmm.
not doing anything. And when you get a spot instance, you pay, it's really cheap, but it could disappear at any time. So it's kind of perfect for those kind of clusters, building up these massive clusters. And then as soon as they're done, it'll kill them. So this guy did a demonstration where he did, an example job. And it did 30 CPU hours in the space of about 5 minutes, and it was all pretty much automated, and it cost about 50p. So the guy that I think he worked for Amazon, but he was saying that he used to work in universities and so on, and to do that, to spin up that amount of computing power and do that job, in the old days you would have had to, you know, acquire all that hardware, set up the hardware, spend all that time doing that, and then, you know, you'd obviously use it at a later date. But yeah, that's quite a powerful thing. You don't need to make that investment. You can just point at AWS, run your scientific computing job, and then tear it back down again. And I thought that was really interesting.
Wow!
You know, anyone can do it, and it's freely available on the AWS marketplace. If anyone wants to go there, I'll put a link in the show notes. And I actually sought these people out afterwards, and said thank you for the talk, because it was it's really interesting. So all right, if anyone's got any number crunching they want to do, they're not too worried about data security and so on, yeah, consider that. So I only say that because AWS and NSA and so on.
So you're basically saying when your computers aren't being used, you can kind of get cheap use of the HPC then, basically. Is that what you're saying, kind of thing?
Yeah, well what spot instances are is, you can go to AWS and you can say, I want some instances. You can spin them up, but you pay a premium for that. Whereas if you go and say, I want a spot instance, but you understand that it may any one of them might disappear at any time, then they're really cheap. But it's quite a low probability that they'll disappear, but then there's always that chance. So if you've got a load of nodes doing a parallel computation problem, and you don't care if one of them drops out, you just rerun that bit again. Mm-hmm. It's really, really good. And I think they did do another demo with computational fluid dynamics, where you could actually bring up a VNC display and have this kind of real-time 3D data visualization stuff going on, which that was really impressive as well. And all for a few quid, money well spent, I'd say.
Cool. All right. Okay. Well, I've got to go and do some Pokemon Go.
Everyone's talking about that. Like, my kids have just downloaded it.
I think I missed Pokemon when I was just a little bit older.
Yeah, me too.
I'm sure my little kid's going to be asking about it soon. So
everyone at school's going to have it already. It's free though, apparently. So I don't know how they're going to monetize it. I don't know.
I think you have to go and collect them, and then you can fight with them or something.
Now in-game purchases that you can do to kind of buy better whatever to get power things powered up to a faster and to do something with something else which uses a thingy, and I've no idea what I'm talking about.
I know
but that's how they make. Well, that's how they're going to make the money, you know. I mean, there's a lot of free apps, isn't there, where you have to, in-app.
Yeah.
You download it for free to get you hooked in. And then next minute, the kids all want, an electric Pokeball or something that powers up a Pokemon to a water type or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
We've had a nightmare with it today, actually, with all that. I've been trying to keep out the way of it.
I've just seen all about it on social media, and so I'm kind of scratching my head a bit, because I don't understand it. Maybe I'm too old.
I posted a little picture, which is from... there's a Next Generation episode called The Game, where they've all been to Ricer, I think, on the next generation, and then they're passing this game around that they put over their heads, and everyone's walking around with this thing on their head. And it just reminded me of when I saw it, it reminded me, I thought, God, that's just the same as this, because I've been looking out the window and there's kids walking around and my lads walking around, and they're all walking around looking at the phone. You know, it's worse than texting. You know, you see people walking around texting with the phone. You know, but with the Pokemon thing, they don't even look up. You know, they're just walking around.
Doesn't it superimpose something on the, you know, it takes a picture of, from your camera on your phone?
Yeah, it can do, yeah. But it uses a kind of Google Map, I suppose, in a way, and a GPS to figure out exactly where you are. And then you have to go to places where there's woods, lakes, you know, and you can get different Pokemon in different areas of woodland or city centres or, you know, lakes or seaside or whatever. And so it uses that, but you can also put onto camera mode. So, you know, you can point the camera at down the road or whatever, and then you can see the Pokemon on the screen.
Yeah, right.
It's very clever, I think. It's a clever game. And I tell you, the other thing it does is it gets kids out and about walking around, doesn't it?
Yeah. Even if they are staring at their phones.
Well, yeah. It's a form of exercise without them realising it's exercise. And all of a sudden they're running around everywhere and they're saying, oh, if you go up here, you can find something or other, you know. And then some of the things, you've got to walk 5 kilometres to get something else, I think it is. So it's clever in that respect, getting kids out and about and walking around.
It reminds me a bit of Ingress. Have you heard of the game Ingress?
No.
It's a kind of GPS-based thing. I think it was Google or some like little Google-funded thing.
Yeah.
And a load of people that I know got into it, and it's basically, you know, you go to somewhere and you it's called hacking the portal. You just basically go there and, you know, tap on your phone, and then you've got, I think, I can't remember what the colours the teams are, I think it's green and blue or something,
right?
So wherever you go, you've got like a certain number of green portals, a certain number of blue portals or whatever the colour is, and you've got to go and hack the portal. So like these guys are always walking around with their phones, like, and when they go to a new place, they find out, you know, how many portals they need to hack. And but the thing is, it contains the battery on their phone. So all these guys have got battery packs for their phones. Like, you can tell all the Ingress players because they've got battery packs for their phones because they're using GPS all the time. So.
Yeah, I've got one of those little battery power packs. And 10 amp hour it is. It lasts for ages.
Yeah.
I use it for my camcorder mainly for recording video and that.
Yeah. It can charge a whole phone. Yeah, you can charge a phone. Like, I think my missus has got one. You can charge 2 phones to 100%.
That's right. Yeah. I run my camera that I use for filming when I'm doing my filming. And it can run the camera for 10 hours of constant recording. Yeah, right. It's longer than my SD card.
Yeah.
So it's great if you're out and about and you've got no power.
Because that Tim from Geeksters, the podcast we're on, he's been the Ingress kind of thing. Got caught by the cops kind of thing because I thought he was loitering somewhere. So
I was trying to hack somewhere that he shouldn't have.
Yeah. Well, I don't know what's happened to the Geeksters lately because we haven't had an episode for a long time from them.
Right. That's a good point, yeah. I hadn't really noticed, but you're right.
I think the last time, according to my thing, it was like, yeah, so...
Well, if you're listening, guys, you know, get in touch.
Yeah, I might drop Martin, the band, their message saying, where are you? I think they're going to... Yeah, February 21st was the last time they were on, kind of thing.
Wow.
So, yeah. I used to enjoy listening to them.
Yeah. Well, maybe it was one Ingress portal too far, like I said. You never know. They're detained at Her Majesty's pleasure.
All right. Cool, okay, guys.
We were on an episode of the Geeksters, weren't we, ages ago? Probably, I don't know when it was now, 18 months ago or so, something.
Probably.
Yeah. It's quite funny, that one.
It was quite good, because we were quite up late, weren't we, doing that? It was like 2 in the morning or something, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. Yeah. It's all nice for them in the evening, you know, early evening. And there's us at 2 in the morning on a...
Okay.
Well, I've never been on someone else's podcast. Feeling left out now.
Okay, so we're all done, aren't we? I don't know how far we are in this one, to be honest. We've gone over the hour, so I think we're good, aren't we?
Cool. All right, then. Well, hopefully see you soon, then. Remember all the media outlets, the Google Plus and the Twitter and stuff.
And also, you can mail us at mail@admin.podcast.co.uk.
Yeah. Cool. So we will see you all soon.
Yep. See you soon.
Bye.